Going right now is we have for the first time a Jesuit Pope, and he is consolidating power within the church, although it's got some issues right now. But it's also his job to bring down the Catholic Church, to totally de-Christianize it. And I think not only through doctrine, but also with what we also see with the other problems of pedophilia and things that are going on within the church. I think that's all part of that design to bring it down so that they can actually recreate it.
Episode of the Sharpie Nerd Report. I'm your host, Sam Johnson. We're found on YouTube, iTunes, Blog Talk, and you can find me at Twitter at Sam T. Johnson. As you can see, we are not in the normal studio where I normally film. That's because I am actually on the road, but that's not going to stop me from putting out a show. And it's just been crazy with these current events going on. It seems like everyone in our world today is, in fact, a Nazi. Trump's a Nazi, Kaepernick's a Nazi, Obama's a Nazi, I'm a Nazi, you're a Nazi, everyone's a Nazi these days, and well, what does that just mean? What does it mean to be a Nazi, the real term, and where do they come from, and what happened in World War II, and who was Hitler, and all those things? Well, we are joined by Mr. Gary Wayne to talk about the actual truth behind the Nazi movement, not just a loosely thrown around insult, but actually the technology that they brought about, the ancient religions that they tied into, and where the heck Hitler came from. So without further ado, Mr. Wayne, how are you doing today?
I am doing just excellent tonight, and very much looking forward to this conversation because, you know, I think as you were outlining in your opening comments, that this term Nazi is thrown around as a, you know, extreme right-wing group that is full of misnomers. And I think it's going to be very interesting as we sort of drill down on that. And we, you know, I'm sure we'll dig into their actual history as well so that people do have a very good understanding when we're done. So very much looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. But before we get to that moment, I know you've been on the Sharpie Report actually a couple times back when Josh hosted it. Can you just give us a little bit of background on who you are and where you come from and how did you get into the Genesis 6 type of things?
Yeah, so when I was on my way back to God after leaving it, after being brainwashed in high school and peer groups and obviously a little bit weak-minded when I was young, I was challenged to read a book by Hal Lindsey called The Late Great Planet Earth, and was challenged by my brother to do so because we were talking about it, and I'm kind of really just sort of poo-pooing it, and they said, no, if you got the courage, read this book. So I did. And so I wanted to verify what Hal was writing about, which I did, because I cataloged all the prophecy throughout the Bible over the next 5 years or so. And that was in about 1979, 1980, when I started to do that. And as I was cataloging things and connecting things back to the different prophecy narratives, you run across these interesting characters in Genesis 6 called the sons of God and the giants and the Nephilim, depending on which translation that you're referring to. And you have them show up again after the flood, and you have them show up in the New Testament in terms of the demons and in terms of the fallen angels and in terms of Revelation 9. And I wanted to connect the two after I'd done all this research on prophecy, just as a project to see whether or not I could actually craft a book, write a book, and get it published, and whether or not people might want to read it. So I thought it would be the shortest book I would ever write, and it's turned out to be probably the longest book I'll ever write, because once I got into it and I started mixing in different mythologies and different religions and history, because I'm also a mythology and a history buff, I went down a lot of rabbit holes in terms of seeing what they had to say. And just so the audience understands, and I think I've said this 1,000 times, but one more time, I'm going to say it just so that people understand, is I measure everything that I research outside the Bible against what it says in the Bible, which is, again, part of my contrarian nature. So that's how I got into it. And it just went down so many rabbit holes, and including the secret societies, that it took me over 10 years to complete the book, because every time I thought I was done, and I wanted to be done so many times, God would just lead me to more information or more books, and then I'd have to digest that, and then I have to go through and weave it all the way through a very, very long book to have it make sense. So, but finally it was done, and I reduced it by about 300 some odd pages just to get it to a size where it could be published. So it was a long process, and it was a very interesting process and a very eye-opening process that I went through. So, and obviously I think when you read what I have to write in my book, or you listen to any of my interviews, one of the keys to prophecy is to be able to understand prehistory. And prehistory as it's written in the Bible, and then you can use other sources for additional context if it fits with what the Bible says. So it's one of those things that I'm very glad that I did. I don't know whether I'll write another book on the same subject, because I have so many other things in prophecy that I want to write about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's definitely it's the way you write, and the topics that you touch on are so interesting, and it seems like everything that you write on goes back to the prehistory, like you were saying. And even when we're talking about things like Nazi Germany and the Nazi movement, it has its ties to this prehistory, and it's super fascinating when we go in, and let's just do that. Let's dive into the prehistory aspects of the Nazi regime.
Sure. So the Nazis, they believe in several different sort of mythologies and legends that they would call in the occult or the polytheist religions their history. And so there's one interesting secret society, and the Nazis are formed in World War II by multiple secret societies, just as we have secret societies that are working to put the end time together today and form world government and form the universal religion. But this society is called the Thule Society. And the Thule Society is based on a island empire like Atlantis. So either it is Atlantis, or it is one of the other antediluvian civilizations the occult has all sorts of writings on. It's not clear which. I think it is Atlantis, because they come from the Aryan perspective in this Thule Society, that they believe they are ancient Aryans, which, of course, everybody's familiar with the Aryan connections to the Nazis. But they believe the Aryans wear blonde hair, blue-eyed giants, which matches up perfectly with Atlantis, because the recollections, whether it's coming out of Egypt or Greece or through the Kisha Maya and other locations and cultures around the world, they were basically blue-haired or blue-eyed and blonde hair and red hair and or hazel eyes. So two different eye colors and skin colors. So they take their history back to those giants, and they believe these were giants, and that they believe that they were a great society that sort of devolved. And Hans Horberger was one of their disciples in terms of establishing this into the Nazi mix. And he wrote a book called Glacial Cosmology, and believed that the giants were the Sumerians in the Bible. And so I'm not sure that there were Sumerians. I think they're more from the Greek civilization, as it comes out of Plato and Timaeus. But he also influenced Hitler greatly, and was believed, and Hitler believed, that these superhumans ruled before the flood, and that these bloodlines have been sort of diluted, and that their genealogy goes back to them. So that's the ancient sort of connection. And that's also overlaid with what they call the Vril ideology. And the Vril ideology is a Rosicrucian ideology. And again, understand that multiple secret societies, along with a perversion, as they would call it, of theosophy, were part of the creation of the Nazis. But the real ideology is that something in the blood goes back to the giants of prehistory. And if you could backwards engineer that, somehow you could recreate this giant race on the earth. And or if you could purify that blood, then you could create that superior race or the new man or a new Nephilim concept, as they were trying to do that. So that sort of takes it back to the prehistory part. And, you know, you even see in Sumeria and with Tammuz, as the god Tammuz, this cross, this Maltese-shaped cross that they adopt into their mythology as well. And then the other part of their mythology, which also deals with bloodlines and goes back into prehistory and connects through the Teutonic Knights and connects back through King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, is the Grail ideology that is also overlaid into the secret society beliefs and into the theosophy beliefs and into the real beliefs and then into this Thule and giant belief. So that's sort of the mix that is going into the ancient side of the Nazis. And then also, not that they use a double eagle, because they don't, although it's part of a lot of the bloodlines using the double eagle or the double phoenix, if you're referring to the Masons' use of the emblem. They did use the eagle, which is a Sumerian or Anunnaki type symbol. So again, that's why they like to connect themselves to the Sumerians, but distinct from the Sumerians as well, because the Sumerians were blackheaded as they come out of history. So it's an interesting mix in terms of how they take their history back.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that going through school, you never hear about the mystical side or the ancient mythology side of Nazi Germany. You just hear about the events that happened. But when you look into Hitler and who and what drove him, it really was this search for ancient knowledge, and even his quest for interesting ancient artifacts that seemed to just drive every step he was doing.
Oh, they were occultic in every sort of aspect. And so much so that when it came to the Nuremberg trials, in trials thereafter that were judging the Nazis for their war crimes, is that Winston Churchill at that time refused to let the information out and entered into the courts of their belief in the occult and the belief in mysticism, because they thought they would be able to use that for an insanity plea. So he didn't permit that. But they were very much after the Grail Hallows or the Spear of Longinus and or the many different treasures that were in sort of that Grail sort of lore and in the history back to the Romans and through the people of Israel and the Essenes. And they did many excavations for these type of artifacts. And Montségur in France was one of these areas that they sent large numbers of people to go excavate for. And what they were looking for were the treasures that Alaric had taken from the Romans when he sacked Rome and then took back to southwest France. And they were following the research of a fellow by the name of Otto Rahn. And this area that they're digging in is the area of the Cathars, which were very much connected to the Templars. And again, you have that Maltese cross again that's also used in the Templars, as it is with the Teutonic Knights, as it is with the SS, because the SS are also based on the Teutonic Knights and King Arthur. And as you get into the layers of their allegories. And so they spend a lot of time digging for these hallows, and they actually send a cablegram back to Germany saying that they found these treasures that Alaric had sent. And there's a partial list that's sent, but we don't get a complete list. But what we do know is that they actually found something. And so when we look at that, they were looking for all of these different things. They were looking, according to what Ron was saying, was in there, was there was the tablets of the testimony of the Exodus, and there was the Ark of the Covenant, and that there was the Holy Grail in there, and the Spear of Longinus, which was the Spear of the Anunnaki, which gave them the right to rule. And so they were looking for all of this stuff. What we do know is they found some treasure there, but we don't know that they found these types of things that Ron had suggested that was there, that Alaric had just pillaged from Rome during the sack in around 400.
Yeah, it sounds just like the Indiana Jones movies.
Exactly. And a lot of that Indiana Jones movies is based on what the Nazis were actually looking for. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of truth to the fiction of those stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would they do theoretically with the artifacts that they were searching for? Were they just trying to harness ancient power? What was the point of that?
Yeah, they thought they would find weaponry. They thought they would find knowledge. They thought they would find technology that would help them conquer the world. And ultimately, that's what they were trying to do. And it would also testify to their religion that they had created, which, again, most people don't understand, is that they were deeply religious, just in an occult religion. And in 1933, after listening to Wagner about, opera of Grail ideology, Hitler announces his forming of the Reichschurch, which is this pan-Aryan type of religion that looks at Jesus as just a mortal prophet in blonde hair and blue-eyed, of course, that was corrupted by the Hebrews into a Messiah-like figure, and corrupted by the Christians into a Messiah-like figure. So I guess not necessarily the Jews, but of course Christians come out of the Jews, so that's why my reference to the Jews in the beginning.
Yeah, and you obviously can't go too long talking about Nazis without talking about Hitler. And you mentioned bloodlines in the beginning. Was he a part of the ancient bloodline that they had kind of brought up?
He doesn't seem to be. Although there's some people out there who believe he was born out of wedlock of some royal bloodlines, but there's not a whole lot there to substantiate it. But it would have been very, very difficult unless he was. And some people believe he actually comes from Rothschild bloodlines, and other people believe he comes from the Habsburg bloodlines. So there's a lot of theories out there, but either or, they do intermix some Jewish bloodlines. So if he was born outside of wedlock, he would have had some Jewish pedigree. But he wasn't interested in being the Jewish Messiah. He was interested in destroying them from the face of the earth.
Yeah.
So I'm not convinced that he did have those Jewish bloodlines.
So what about him? Why did they choose him to be the leader of this movement? Obviously, he was a great speaker, but was that it?
That was it. That was it. And so he comes along in about 1919, and he runs into a fellow by the name of Dietrich Eckart, who hears him speaking. And so they are going to bring him into all of these different organizations and the religion that they call Ariosophy, which is again an expansion with the Vril and the Thule ideology that we were talking about earlier of Theosophy. But Dietrich Eckart is his mentor, and he introduces him into Ariosophy, and he introduces him into the occult and initiates him and teaches him the higher levels of the occult, being an adept of the secret societies. And then he gives him makes him the editor of the newspaper, the Volkisch the Proker, which was, again, Volkisch's ideology of the Grail that's being overlaid into theosophy. And he was also, actually, he was the editor of the Nazi newspaper, not Hitler, sorry. And he was also a member of the Thule Society. And so that's how they bring him in. And he is just to be sort of the front man to sort of rally the Germans to their cause. But he obviously gets out of control. And again, down the road, they're going to the secret societies are going to deal with him because he absolutely goes rogue. Huh. What's interesting about what Hitler does, he forms the National Socialist Movement. And you hear today about this being a right-wing organization. And Aryan, as we've talked about, the Aryan part is right. Their right wing is not right. The only thing they were right of was socialism, communism, and anarchism. Their philosophy was to blend oligopolies into the socialistic movement and to have those oligopoly companies have no competition and work for the enterprise of the government, which is, slightly farther right of pure socialists, but not much. So this is an extreme left-wing organization. And so when you hear of Antifa, which was also part of the Nazi movement in World War II, and there's pictures that show their organization of Antifa with the Nazi symbols on it, because they were part of that anarchist move that were supporting them, fighting the Nazis of today, that's all for show. Right.
Yeah.
And it's to confuse people. So this is a group that is formed through some other secret organizations that people probably are familiar with. But you have in 1884 having the Fabian Society of England started. And this is a Rosicrucian group. And what they do is they conceive some ideas that people might be familiar with called social justice. They conceive ideas like eugenics, that they want to bring about abortion to control the poor, universal health care, which is a good thing if not misused. And they also invented national socialism that was to be combined and funded by capitalism. So that's those oligopolies that we had talked about. And they also established the Labour Party in England. And this was funded by, of course, the Rothschilds and the banking communities. And so when we talk about Nazis, we need to talk about secret societies, because even the Nazis of today, what they, the Aryan nations, that's an initiatory organization, just as the KKK were. These are left-wing groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said something that's really interesting that I guess I've never thought of before. You said that they promoted Hitler through the ranks, obviously, until he went off course and kind of started to not fulfill what they wanted to do anymore. So then these secret societies took him down. And is that what happened? That just kind of sparked my interest.
Yeah, it is exactly what happened. So the secret societies, and particularly the Rosicrucians and some other organizations, are going to work to create this German movement after World War II, and they're going to fund them. Even though this is working towards moving forward, it doesn't really gain traction until it's funded, and I'll tell you how it's funded in a few minutes. So the ideology is that the communists were also organized to take over Russia, but they go rogue on them. And because, again, the founding members are Masonic, and they're funded by the Western banks. And I document this in my book for people who want to dig deeper on the communist aspect. So now they need something that's going to offset the communists, because they can't control communism anymore. And so they're going to fund the Nazis, and they're going to be funded by the Western banks again and sponsored by the Rothschilds. And so they're going to try and use them to counter the communists. And the money is going to be funneled to the Schroeder Bank and the Reichstag Bank that's controlled by BIS. That is funneling the money from the Western banks, and that's the Bank of International Settlements, as it's called. And this money funds the rise of the Nazis to power, and then they usurp and kick out and stop democracy on route to complete totalitarianism. And so, again, this history that people don't really understand about how the Nazis came about, this wasn't just because Germans were poor. This was funded and organized because the secret societies want to bring about the end time and world government. And I don't care whether it's democracy or totalitarianism, because at the end of the day, they're going to turn it into totalitarian rule. So the ends don't, they already know the end. They don't really care about the avenue, but they're going to work every possible avenue to get there. But when they start to turn against the Jewish people, which will even include a significant part of the secret societies who control the money, then they're going to fund England and they're going to fund America to put down the Germans, because Hitler gets absolutely out of control and decides he is the Messiah. And what's really important for people to understand about the Nazis is that this is a parallel to the end time. Not everything runs perfectly consistent, but a lot of it does. And just as Hitler is a messiah-like figure, and he believes he's an avatar of the ancient, an avatar of the ancient giants, so he's demon-possessed, or possessed by a fallen angel is what he believes, that he is this messianic figure that is godlike. And so he's like an Antichrist figure, right? And then
Nostradamus, he would be the second Antichrist, yes, according to his prophecy.
Yeah, and again, what's similar about him to Napoleon, who you're referring to, is that both usurp power. And what's both similar about them is you know, Napoleon is de-Christianizing France at that time, and all the churches, the Christian churches, are now swung over, even before Napoleon rises, by the triumvirates to, they're dedicated to ISIS, and to, they're going to bring about the cult of reason. And again, this is the secret societies and that Gnostic religion in play, because Gnosticism is the root of theosophy, and they spawn theosophy to harmonize science and religion for the end time. So when we're talking about similarities in terms of what Nostradamus is talking about, yeah, he fits in quite well to what Nostradamus is talking about. Not that I put a lot of faith in what Nostradamus talks about, but and also we look at what's going on with the Nazis, is they have this rapid advancement of technology.
Yeah.
That comes out of nowhere. Like, they have these tanks, you know, the Panzers and the Tiger tanks, which are the standard for the design even to this day. I mean, they're absolutely light years ahead of everybody else with their heavy armor, their low profile, and their ability to shoot long distances with significantly larger size shells than what either the Americans or the Russians had. Their problem was that they couldn't produce enough of them fast enough. And you also look at, where did their strategy come from? That was Blitzkrieg, that just revolutionized war, and they overran so many countries until the Allies actually adapted that type of warfare, you know, partway through the war. They also developed things like, they were on their way to developing an atomic bomb. They developed the Enigma that was thought to be uncrackable encoding system, and the only way it was decoded is actually got a Enigma machine off of a submarine, the Americans did, and were able to match it up, and then were able to read everything the Nazis were transmitting. So they were able to develop that. They developed, you know, rockets.
Yeah.
They developed jet engines. They developed the single-winged airplane that was radar, was stealth, I guess is the right word for that. And they developed a bell-shaped device that people think could go interdimensional. And if you start thinking about the end time with that, you think about Revelation 9 and getting and opening up the abyss, and you wonder whether or not they were trying to do that. So, and what do we see as we approach the end time? Is we see this again, this almost unaccounted for ramp up of knowledge in all aspects as we go into the end time. And again, I think this is what happened before the flood, and that their technology was significantly greater than what people realize, and probably greater than what we have today, because we're not in the end time yet. If we look at what Jesus said, that it's going to be like the end time. And you also have these analogies that you have this polytheist religion. And it's going to be a very similar Gnostic-type religion that's also going to cause a genocide, two genocides in the end time, as well as attacking Israel and Judah. And you see that as an analogy. You also see him with the throne of Satan, or the throne that Antichrist is going to have himself crowned king of the world in the temple. And what I'm talking about, the throne of Satan, is I'm talking about the throne and the altar at Pergamum that is brought back to Germany. It's found in the 1800s, but it's brought back to Germany as the throne of Satan. And this is, I don't think he was planning to be crowned king of the world in Jerusalem. I think he was planning on using this for a similar type of crowning, but back in Berlin. So again, we have similarity there. We have he's clearly trying to take over the world, and he calls it the Third Reich that's going to reign for 1,000 years. Again, trying to emulate the millennium and all of these types of things you have going on in prophecy in the end time. So I think if you want to have an understanding, only not as technologically advanced to the end time, one needs to have a very close look at what went on in Nazi Germany, not only from their religion and the secret societies, but all of these other sort of aspects that make him an Antichrist type figure.
Yeah, and the technology aspect is so fascinating, because people forget that they started to create all these things coming off of World War I, where they didn't, their economy was in ruins, they didn't have any sort of structure, and all of a sudden they're producing all these brand new technologies, and it just seems like they're unstoppable force because they're so far ahead of everyone. You look at it like, how is that possible? You have to start to incorporate that aspect into the ancient religions and trying to contact the watchers to get that knowledge.
Well, and again, that's where the secret societies and that mystical religion comes back in. Mm-hmm. So if you, as they interviewed some of the Nazis and found out that they were adepts, and they believed they were actually talking to the Great White Brotherhood or the Celestial Masters or whatever you want to call them, and whether or not they're demons or they're fallen angels or whomever they were talking to, they said they were receiving this knowledge from them. And this knowledge is so great that you have Operation Paperclip, as I recall, launched by the U.S. government, and they are going to round up as many scientists as possible working on all these projects and take them back. And these are the same scientists that are going to launch the rocket program that's going to take essentially the Apollo program and to the moon and all the other things that came along thereafter. So I think there was this ramping up of knowledge that was clear from the U.S. government side that was too powerful to fall into the Russian hands, and so far ahead of what they were able to understand that they needed the help to do it. And I think that's another sort of testimony to the idea that they had this rapid development that is unaccounted for, and I look at as extraordinary help from who they were worshiping and who they were following.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting theories saying that like the Nazis didn't really lose World War II. They just kind of changed their strategy, and you even have conspiracy theories of Hitler going over to Argentina because he didn't actually commit suicide. So do you subscribe to the theory maybe that Nazis didn't really lose World War II? They just tried to, you know, use things like Operation Paperclip to go underground and try to change other countries within?
Well, I would certainly say they lost World War II. When you have your country destroyed as completely as they did.
Yeah.
But what you can't destroy is the ideology, right? You can't destroy the knowledge, and you can't necessarily stop fanatical people from trying to continue. And whether or not they're behind it or it's a more controlled left-wing version, it will still get out of control in the end time, is what we're going to see with what it's going to do. But I do believe that is the system that will be dominated in the end time, and we see it rising. This is what is in Russia today with the oligarchs and oligopolies there. This is the capitalism, if you call it, this very much a controlled by the elites or the adepts capitalism, where there isn't much competition. That's why it's an oligopoly as opposed to a monopoly that China has produced. This is now what we're seeing with the rise of international corporations, which are generally run by left-wing people and money who own the shares in there. And if you look at, you know, again, as what we're seeing in the high-tech end, it's being run by oligopolies. And you're going to see this as become the norm. And all of these, as we're starting to see, just as they do in Russia and just as they do in China today, and particularly as we're seeing on the high tech companies, they are doing the left wing agenda as part of their corporate culture and as part of their corporate goals and agenda. And I think we're going to see that become more so, because I think this is the style of government, and that's going to be matched with this polytheist religion of the end time.
Interesting. Yeah, you definitely see a lot of the ideologies even seeping into the Western culture today. Obviously, a lot of the actual funders of Nazi Germany's were based out of places like the United States. I mean, you alluded to it. You even have the Bush family, strong ties, and you have George Soros over here. There's some interesting dynamics at play there as well. So you have the same types of secret societies pushing a lot of our agendas here today. So it's been really interesting to see the insult being thrown around so much, like I talked about in the beginning, of Nazi Germany. So why do you think that insult starting to creep up in our culture?
Because it's misdirection, so that you're going to taint and color the opposition with what you're actually doing. And it's a very, very common trait that you see, or let's call it a tactic, because it's a tactic, is they call us, whether we're Christian or we're right wing or we're white or however they want to divide, they call us racist and they call us a whole bunch of horrible things, right? And yet they're the ones that are doing the hate. But guess what? All the vulnerable people who don't critically look at things believe it. So you're going to see more and more and more of that. And they have to bring Christianity into a position of isolation so that they can persecute them, just as what they did to the Jewish people in World War II. So they're setting up the long game. I mean, Hitler just didn't start propaganda, and the Nazis just didn't start propaganda against the Jewish people in 1933. They were starting it well in advance of that. And it just became part of their governing platform that they were going to rid the world of this menace. They're going to try and rid the world of Christians in the end time. So they're getting people prepared for this. And they do a very, very good job of preparing the world with brainwashing to accept the delusions and the lies that they're going to bring about in the end time. So that's that whole thing about calling who disagrees with them racists and Nazis or whatever else you want to add on to that list, and it's a big list, is the tactic to make them look like who you actually are underneath. But you can see everything that they do is divide, and it's racist, and it's bigoted, and it comes with hate. And they're the ones who do the violence. But yet they say it's the Christians and the people who have right-wing leanings who are the violent ones. But they're the ones doing the violence. And in this case, you know, that happened that Trump got himself involved on, where there was just a great opportunity for them to test their tactics. You have two left-wing groups going at each other, and they're both disgusting. But they're both left-wing.
Yeah, it seems, you know, we talk about Nazi Germany, a lot of their movement to take over the world was war-based and force-based, but it seems like today the ideas they're trying to push us, instead of a one-world government first, they're kind of trying to push us towards maybe a one-world religion before they get to the world government.
Yeah, and or they want to create it so that Antichrist can just step in and take over at a certain point in time. So I agree with your conclusion that the religion's going to come first. And I think I think we're seeing more of a political push towards world government as opposed to the religious push right now. But I would expect that to flip around as we get closer to the end time, because you know, you have this covenant of that's going to start off the last 7 years, and Antichrist isn't crowned Antichrist or King of the World until the 3.5 year point. So you're going to have this 10-nation world government, and I think it's more not 10 nations. I think it's 10 groups of nations. I think it's 10 trading blocks, spheres of influence, whatever you want to call them, that are going to form this end time empire, just as you had 10 in the Atlantean Empire that, you know, the Nazis were basing their ideology on. And just as you have the Club of Rome, which also reports to the Rosicrucians, that's created in the late 60s, who have divided the world into 10 groups of nations or spheres of influence and so on and so forth.
Well, can you expand on the Club of Rome? I don't think I've heard that before.
Well, they're formed in the 60s. They're a relatively new agency, and their whole goal that they were formed for was to do exactly what I said. And so you have a lot of concepts that we have that came out of them, like overpopulation and peak oil and global warming. Those are all concepts pioneered by this group to try and cattle herd people into world government through fear and to bring down the borders. And that's what their job is. All of the secret societies have a different role, and people need to understand how that hierarchy works and what those roles are if you want to understand the influence of the secret societies. So they report directly to the Rosicrucians and to the purebloods of the Rosicrucians. And you know, when in the 60s, when they were formed, Pierre Trudeau, who's the father of Justin Trudeau, was one of the members of the Club of Rome. And I'm from Canada, and on CBC television, they would have them a few times showing him going into a Club of Rome meeting. And then that sort of all disappeared. So, but if somebody wants to Google the Club of Rome, they're, you know, it's easy to get information on it. But that was their role, and they're still working on that role to make it happen. And that's why you saw all of these free trade agreements being formed starting in the 80s from their work, and that they were forming them into trading blocks like NAFTA or the EEC. And so you'll see that as sort of the archetypical structure of what they're looking to do for that end time world government.
Yeah, well, I want to keep going at that, because there's so many different secret society names that gets thrown at us constantly through, you know, great interviews like this one, but I've never heard how they each have a specific role and job in doing different things. So I want to talk about that more. I don't even know how to phrase a question around that, but that's really interesting to me that they're laid out like that.
Well, so you go back to the modern organizations that most people are familiar with. These are created because one central organization in 1307 is ended, and that's the Knights Templar, who we also, you know, our sister order, the Teutonic Knights, which is sort of that northern Volkisch knight order out of Germany that the Teutonic Knights or the SS is based on in Nazi Germany. And so they're going to recreate what the Templars were doing, but they're going to recreate multiple groups so that they can't be taken down quite as easily. And before the fall of the Templars, you have a ritual and a separation going on in the Templars in 1188 at Geyser Castle called the Cutting of Elms. And that's where the Inner Order is going to separate from the Templars because they feel they've lost their way. They're too greedy. And they've also lost Jerusalem in 1187. So that group now takes on the Red Cross aspect forward, and they're going to become the Rosicrucians. And the Rosicrucians are formed of, in that group, of 50% at the top of purebloods, and below are not as pureblood and some of the very, very highly talented. And they're fairly high up in the order. So they're going to now help create and sponsor other political groups going forward. And so Freemasonry shows up right after the fall of the Knights Templar, and they're formed in Scotland. And they're going to fall under the protection of Robert the Bruce, who's been excommunicated by the Pope, at that time for murdering his rival in a Catholic church, which they didn't look fondly upon. And so Freemasonry is going to be rewarded by Robert, the Templar Knights who fight for Robert the Bruce, at the Battle of Bannockburn, and they come on at the end of the day and win the day for the Scots, according to Albert Mackey in the History of Freemasonry, who's one of their great patriarchs and historical writers and other writers within the craft. Freemasonry is going to be set up to create an organization that is going to affect the military and is going to affect the politics. And that's where they're going to be heavily involved on. And as it rolls a little bit more down the road, they're going to affect the media as part of their sphere of influence. And they're also to be a preparatory organization to introduce people into occultism and come to the first level of adepthood at the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite or the third degree of the York Rite. So that's the two groups. Now, the Rosicrucians, who I talked about a few minutes ago, it's their job to perpetuate the pursuits of Thoth, or this ancient knowledge, and protect that knowledge. It's their job to develop, you know, continue to develop alchemy, which they say has the power to destroy worlds and even more, and develop the absolute science and develop that knowledge. And it's their job to perpetuate the history and the beliefs through literature and entertainment. That's why you have fairy tales and King Arthur and science fiction that all represents their beliefs and their religion. And then you have the Illuminati that's going to be formed again in the 1500s, although most people just date them to the 1700s, but they actually go back further. And their job is to form world government and to destroy Christianity on the outside of the Catholic Church. But they will assist to also try and work with bringing down the Roman Church as well. You also have the Jesuits, who are formed. Two of the members are Bazikis, which is an interesting group because they call themselves Homo Atlantis, and were the people who they say, this is them talking, not me, created the post-Diluvian societies of Egypt, Scythia, and Mesopotamia. And so their job is to get control of education within the church, to be on the front end of where the Roman Church is going. That's why you see Jesuit priests on all the explorations, particularly into North America, destroying, controlling the information and what's going to happen going forward, and to ensure they get control over the end for the Roman Church for the end time. That's the role. And now we actually have a Jesuit on as a pope on in the Vatican for the Roman Church. And you also have, coming together in 1660, the Masons, the Freemasons, and the Rosicrucians to form the Royal Society. Their job is to control and develop the sciences and to lead people away from God with the sciences, which they do a very, very good job of, to control the education and to honor their gods of their pantheon. And I think they, you know, they've done a very good job. So now they've got control of the education in the West, inside the Catholic side, and also through Protestantism. And then you have the Rothschilds being created, originally the Bauer family, until they set up the London Bank in 1798, and they changed their name from Bauer to Rothschilds, which is the red shield or the red sign, right, which is that Rosicrucian symbol. And so they've been intermarrying all the time to ennoble their bloodlines, because they come from a very sort of lower level of bloodlines. And so the Templars were great bankers. So all of these groups were created to do what the Templars were doing afterwards. And so if you have, look at the hierarchy sort of quickly, you go Freemasonry, Illuminati, Rosicrucian. And then you have all sorts of organizations funneling directly into, on the outside, into the Rosicrucians, because 50% at the higher end are the purebloods, which are going to report higher up to the Committee of 300, which goes to the Council of 33, which goes to the 13 families, which is just sort of the European bloodlines in terms of this end of the secret societies in the Western part of the world. And so whether it's the Bilderbergers or the Bohemian Grove, they're all going to intersect just like the Club of Rome does, directly into answering to the Rosicrucians, just as these other groups all answer to the Rosicrucians.
Wow, that was amazingly well done and well put. Very clear. I really appreciate that. I've never heard it broken down like that. So to tie it back to the original topic, which is Nazi Germany, obviously all of these groups had a play in forming Nazi Germany, and they also have a large hand in what America and what the Western cultures throughout Europe are doing today. So seeing where Germany went, what do we have to look for going forward from our current position that we really need to keep an eye on, because that might be some red flags that we really need to start adjusting?
I think we need to keep an eye on first to the rise of the religion, of the universal religion, as we look. If somebody buys into the fact, as I do, that we may not be in the end time, but we can see it on the horizon, I think. And we understand that you need a universal government and you need a world universal government and a universal religion as a prerequisite for the end time. Then I think we need to look for the religion to rise first. And so what we do have ongoing right now is we have, for the first time, a Jesuit pope. And he is consolidating power within the church, although it's got some issues right now. But it's also his job to bring down the Catholic Church, to totally de-Christianize it. And I think not only through doctrine, but also with what we also see with the other problems of pedophilia and things that are going on within the church. I think that's all part of that design to bring it down so that they can actually recreate it. And so you also see him reaching out to the Anglicans, who are very much closely associated with the Catholics again, and he's doing overreaches into the rest of Protestantism to bring them back into one church. And again, we need to understand that that the Christian churches outside of the Roman Church, all of the Protestant churches, have been infiltrated for a very long period of time by Gnostic moles, who are also changing the doctrines. And everybody's moving towards an interpretive allegorical approach, which is the Gnostic approach. And of course, the Jesuits interpreted, when they were formed, they interpret everything through the seven sacred sciences, which is the pinnacle of the formation of the antediluvian secret society of Freemasonry, which these seven sciences, which are developed by Enoch, son of Cain, as opposed to Enoch, son of Jared, are going to be developed. And to continue that develop, they're going to develop the secret societies, and they're also going to develop the mystical religion. So they have this partnership that goes way back into prehistory, and then will merge with the creation of the Nephilim in the time of Noah, and they're going to totally destroy the end of the world. So with all of that, then you need to understand that this religion and world government has to come together with these bloodlines, or a recreation of the Nephilim, and I come at it from more of a perspective of the bloodlines. So now you also see with all of this going on that you have all of these events sponsored by the Vatican to bring in the other religions. So they're trying to build bridges, and at the same time, there's going to have to be something that's going to totally disrupt Christianity and convince people to buy into this new improved religion. And they're going to do that with a number of things in terms of discrediting it. They're going to use the allegorical approach to say that the Bible is a fairy tale, and that you need to understand it. You need to understand the mysticism that's written in underneath, according to what they say. They're going to say that Jesus did not resurrect, and that is an allegory. That's why the allegorical approach is so important. And they're going to use something like Jesus saying, the only sign I'm going to give the wicked generation that he visited with is the sign of Jonah. And you hear them out there saying all the time, well, Jonah's a parable. It's not true. There's no way it could be true. Somebody couldn't survive in a whale. And that's so that they can bring that about when they're ready to say that was the sign Jesus gave. So if he was referring to a parable, then his resurrection is a fable or a fairy tale. And so then they're going to say, they're going to present proof that Jesus didn't die on the cross. And the only way you can bring down Christianity is to destroy the idea that Jesus resurrected. Just as Paul said, our faith stands on that single fact and truth. So they're going to bring overwhelming false evidence to bear to shake Christianity to the knees, and while having control of it, fold it in with the polytheist religions. Because they look at monotheism as going rogue after the time of Moses. That they felt that Moses, in their belief system, not what I believe or not what the Bible says, was educated at Heliopolis, which he probably was, and he brought polytheism to the Israelites. But at some point down the road, it went rogue and became monotheism. So they look at this as a false religion, and they look at Christianity and Judaism as an evil religion. So they're going to hit it on all of those different aspects.
Wow, that is super fascinating. Definitely a lot of things to look forward to, look forward to things happening. It's definitely interesting, and I appreciate you laying it out. We actually have hit our hour mark with this conversation. There's so much more I wanted to ask you, but we'll definitely have you back on the show. But before I let you go, where can people find you? How can they support you? And do you have anything coming up soon?
Yes. So if you're looking to contact me, you can contact me through my website at the Genesis6Conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6 with the number 6Conspiracy.com. If you have a question, you can contact me through the email that's on there. You can also get a look at my book, and you'll get a generous excerpt on all 98 chapters about my book on there. And I've got some interviews up there as well if you want to get a flavor for some more of my interviews. And you can also get a hold of me or follow me on Facebook. And I put out generally a very interesting, in-depth article, whether it's on prophecy, secret societies, or giants, about once every week. And I have one coming out later this week that I think is very good on, you know, the biblical case for giants in the covenant land during the time of the covenant or time of the Exodus. And you can also follow me on Twitter at GaryWayne63, at GaryWayne63. And as in terms of what I've got coming up, only contact me through any of those sites. And if you have a question, I will get back to you. As for what I've got coming up, I will be doing a conference in November in Dallas. It's Operation Top Secret, as I recall the name, and there'll be more information coming out, and it's to fund General Mike Flynn and his defense expenses that he has incurred. So,
wonderful. Well, that is definitely, go support him, everyone. Go to his website, go follow him on the social media, do what you can, because if you liked this interview today, well, this really just scratched the surface on so many different topics that Mr. Wayne dives deep into, and he'll really further your understanding a lot of different things. So, Mr. Wayne, thank you so much for coming on the Sharpener Report. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and hopefully we've raised some interest in the audience today.
Yeah, absolutely we have. Well, that's our show today, or this week, guys. It's so important to know what the forces are driving each movement that's taken. Whether you support Trump or you don't, you have to think about what role he plays into it. Is he following a bunch of different secret societies, or is he standing against it? Because these secret societies are in our culture. They are trying to force us to these end times and to make this playbook happen on their watch instead of what God has planned for everything. So you have to be prepared, you have to stand against it, and it's your job to be informed. So I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm not going to ask you to like, subscribe, or share, but you know I appreciate it if you do. I hope you enjoy the show, and I hope that you have a great week.